Good morning, everybody. If we could come on in so we can get started, because today we have two speakers talking about a very important topic. First, since we are going to have two speakers, what I think we should probably do is hold all questions till the end and then have you ask questions for the two speakers together. This morning, our first speaker is Dr. And I'm going to introduce both of them right now so we can just get it going that way, is Dr. Seth Baum, who is a cardiologist in private practice. Dr. Baum, let's see where, he went to Columbia College and the College of Physicians and Surgeons in New York for his MD and trained in New York at NYU Medical Center and New York Medical College for his cardiology. He's been involved in cardiology from intervention to EPS to now preventive cardiology, and he is the president-elect of the American Society for Preventive Cardiology, so we can still vote and change that, I guess. No. Our other speaker today is Dr. Gregory Cohen, who is an internist who specializes in cardiovascular disease prevention. And he's been around, too. He trained in Philadelphia at Thomas Jefferson, where he went to medical school, and then he did his internal medicine residency at Thomas Jefferson, but he's also done a fellowship in preventive cardiology at Johns Hopkins. And today they're going to talk about this new and upcoming topic of PCSK9 inhibitors. I'd like to welcome Dr. Baum's going to talk first, and then Dr. Cohen.
Thank you, John, and thank you for trying to vote me out of the presidency. I appreciate that. So today, this is obviously we're doing a team effort on PCSK9 inhibitors. It's certainly a very big topic, and we're both going to tackle different things. I'm going to discuss the biology of PCSK9 and a little bit of PCSK9 inhibitors, and review some lipidology to set the stage for Greg to talk about the outcomes, not the outcome trial, the trials, and potentially future outcome trial hints, perhaps. These are my disclosures. So let's start with cholesterol, understanding cholesterol. It was in the early 1900s when a niche cow, a medical student, because in the olden days it was always the medical students who did everything cool, a medical student fed a bunch of rabbits a high cholesterol diet, sacrificed the rabbits, and found that they had developed aortic plaque, and started to make the connection between cholesterol feeding and atherosclerosis. Then we have 48, Framingham starts, still ongoing. Framingham offspring trials are being published continuously. In 61, Bill Cannell determined very appropriately that cholesterol is actually a risk factor for atherosclerosis. 85, you have Goldstein and Brown winning the Nobel Prize for their work on the LDL receptor. And then in 87, we have the first statin that was FDA approved. So a lot happened over the last century. When we look at LDL, you know, a lot of us were brought up thinking LDL was created by the liver, goes around the body, delivers cholesterol to various tissues, and is a fundamental and important aspect of nourishing our body with cholesterol, because we know that cholesterol is very, very important. In reality, though, it's different. So the liver makes VLDL, or very low-density lipoprotein, which is about 80% triglyceride and 20% cholesterol. VLDL traffics around the body, delivers its cargo, which is predominantly triglyceride, to various tissues. The triglyceride is utilized by these tissues for energy. As it does this, it shrinks, and it becomes IDL, or intermediate density lipoprotein. The intermediate density lipoprotein can have one of two fates. It can either go back to the liver for degradation, or it can continue its trek around the body, delivering more triglyceride. It, too, shrinks down, and it becomes LDL. And LDL's sole purpose in the human being is to be degraded by the liver. That's what it's there for. And I'm going to give you a few examples of why that is. Now, having said that, we have to remember cholesterol is incredibly important. It's involved in multiple aspects of our biology and physiology. It protects our skin from aqueous pollutants. It's a part of bile acid synthesis, vitamin D, and many other functions. It's a vital element of our brain. So if LDL's purpose is to be degraded, where are we getting all the cholesterol? Turns out that every cell in the body has the capacity to manufacture its own cholesterol, and this is very tightly regulated. So if a cell sees its environment depleted of cholesterol, it ramps up its production of cholesterol. And each cell has the capacity to do that. If we look at some animal data, we find something very interesting and surprising, actually, which is that in steroidogenic tissues, the main source of cholesterol is endogenous production by the cells, as I just told you, or HDL, not LDL. So animals derive their cholesterol from endogenous production and HDL. Turley, on the other hand, did some studies which demonstrated, they were kinetic studies, and demonstrated in normal human beings that we actually derive none of our cholesterol in steroidogenic tissues from LDL. It's all endogenously produced in the human. And here we have a study looking at delivering statins for 3 months to individuals and hormone production in these individuals. And you could see that there's absolutely no difference between pre- and post-statin therapy in terms of the cell's ability to produce hormones. But most important is the brain. So our brain is largely comprised of fat, and everybody has been very, very concerned about the impact of medications that lower LDL cholesterol on the brain. And we see that, in fact, the blood-brain barrier is very tight here, and lipoprotein particles don't easily make it their way through the blood-brain barrier. And the brain is actually solely dependent upon endogenous production of cholesterol, which is really a protective mechanism if you think about it. So what the brain is saying is, I don't care what's going on in the body. I'm going to be self-reliant so that if cholesterol levels are ridiculously low or ridiculously high, I'm not going to get in trouble. And that's what the brain does. So through our century of understanding of cholesterol, we've learned several things. We've learned that the trafficking mechanism of cholesterol is entirely different from what we thought, that LDL does not deliver cholesterol to important tissues, that LDL is solely intended to be degraded. It's like garbage trucks of cholesterol. It's excess cholesterol. And the remaining LDL particles actually are what cause vascular disease. And we've learned that specifically steroidogenic tissues in the brain are very much immune to falling levels of LDL in the blood. So now we'll move on to PCSK9. So PCSK9 is a pro-protein. It's pro-protein convertase subtilis and cexin type 9. And it's the ninth in the series of these pro-proteins, and it's very different from the first eight. It's produced in the liver. And in the endoplasmic reticulum, it has five segments initially. That's actually pro-protein convertase subtilis and cexin type 9. So in that state, it has these five segments. It undergoes autocleavage. The first two are chopped off. And one of them, then, the pro-segment, actually comes back on itself and blocks the catalytic site of PCSK9. It then goes through the Golgi and into the blood. And when it goes into the blood, it is only a binding protein. It's the only one of the PCSK series that solely serves as a binding protein. It has no catalytic capacity. And what does it bind? It binds LDL receptors. So its purpose now is to go out into the blood and bind LDL receptors. And I'll show you in depth what that does. This is normal physiology. And I've told you already that LDL is meant to be degraded by the liver. So this is how it happens. LDL has a very large protein that weaves its way in and out of the surface of the particle, and that protein is called ApoB100. So it's on the surface of the particle, weaving its way in and out, and a little portion of it serves as a ligand that binds to the LDL receptor. So LDL particles are floating in the blood. They come upon the LDL receptor in the liver. and then they're internalized through this clathrin-coated pit. And they puncture their way through the clathrin-coated pit into a vesicle and then into an endosome. In the late stage of the endosome development, the pH drops significantly. So it becomes a very acidic environment. And what that does is separate the LDL particle from the LDL receptor. The LDL particle is then shunted off to a lysosome for degradation into amino acids and lipids. The LDL receptor, however, is recycled to the surface of the cell. And the LDL receptor can do this over 150 times. So each LDL receptor is incredibly valuable to us because each LDL receptor can bring in, for degradation, over 150 LDL particles, thus lowering the LDL in our blood. So they're very valuable. Now, enter PCSK9. So PCSK9, I told you, is a binding protein only. So what it's binding the LDL receptor. And here you see it binding the LDL receptor. The LDL particle then comes in. The ligand on ApoB100 binds the LDL receptor at a different site. Now you have three components, the LDL receptor, the LDL particle, and PCSK9. They puncture through that clathrin-coated pit. They enter the vesicle. They enter the endosome. pH drops. Now when the pH drops, it doesn't separate. The LDL particle and LDL receptor fail to separate, and that's because of PCSK9. PCSK9 is actually functioning as glue. It increases the affinity of the LDL receptor to the LDL particle over 150-fold. So it's forming basically a glue between the two of them. And they're both shunted off, including the PCSK9. They're all shunted off to the lysosome for degradation. Everything's destroyed. And we lose the opportunity for that 150 recycles of the LDL receptor to bring LDL into the liver cell for degradation. And what happens to LDL in the blood? It goes up. And that's what PCSK9 does. So we've understood from various genetic variants that PCSK9 is an incredibly powerful modulator of LDL metabolism. And there are mutations called gain-of-function mutations and loss-of-function mutations. And the gain-of-function mutations mean either that PCSK9 is produced more readily or PCSK9 binds more readily to the LDL receptor. There are a variety of types of gain-of-function mutations. And there are a variety of types of loss-of-function mutations where you have less PCSK9 or less effective PCSK9. But the interesting thing is that with the gain-of-function mutations, you have what you think you would have, which is greater destruction of these LDL receptors and higher LDL levels, and as a consequence, higher ASCVD risk. And with loss-of-function mutations, you have the opposite. You have lower levels of LDL cholesterol and consequently lower levels of ASCVD risk. And I'm just going to show you a few slides on the development of this, on how we came to understand this. So it was 2003 when PCSK9 was actually discovered, and initially there was a protein called NARC1 that was being evaluated by a Canadian scientist. Simultaneously, there was a French physician who was looking at a family of familial hypercholesterolemia patients, and they didn't fit into the usual box. And the usual box was mutations in the LDL receptor or ApoB100. They didn't have those mutations. So this physician scientist said, well, wait a second, we got to find this gene. We found another gene that can explain FH. And the Canadian scientist suggested, well, maybe this is NARC1. And in fact, it was. So NARC1 was renamed PCSK9. It was the ninth in that series of PCSKs. And this is just a demonstration of what FH looks like. It's a mutation in one of these three genes. Actually, now there are about six genes that have been identified that can cause FH. But you have a mutation in one of these genes. Here you have mother, father, both with mutation, a single mutation on one allele, and then producing an offspring that is a homozygote, so two mutations. So the homozygotes are obviously much more rare, but also much sicker than the heterozygotes. The homozygotes occur about 1 in 160,000 to 1 in 200,000, whereas the heterozygotes, now we understand the prevalence is about 1 in 200 to 1 in 250. And what that means for everybody in clinical practice is, in your practice, you have patients with FH. The problem is in the United States, we've identified fewer than 10% of FH patients because we still believe it's such a rare disorder that we're never going to see it. And the reality is that everybody's got FH patients in his or her practice. And the importance of identifying these FH patients is that you cascade screen. You screen the entire family, and the sooner you treat these people, the better their outcomes are. So it's very important that we all sort of have this on the tip of our differential diagnostic tongue, if you will. This is a pedigree of that French family demonstrating basically how this is transmitted. And you see these very high levels of LDL and total cholesterol in the heterozygotes. And now we understand that about 2% of FH patients have PCSK9 mutations as the etiology of their FH. Here are some other gain-of-function mutations. You see this list is growing now. They do different things. They have different impacts on PCSK9. And it does cause FH. And this is one of the things you might see, which is an Achilles tendon xanthoma. And one thing I'd like to caution you about is that when you examine pedal pulses, you always reach around and feel the Achilles tendon. So you can get accustomed to feeling how thick an Achilles tendon should be. And it should be about a half a centimeter thick, 5 millimeters. So if you know how thin this thing is, you'll understand that when it gets big, even if it's not like this, which is gigantic and lumpy bumpy, you can have a uniformly thickened Achilles tendon that represents an Achilles tendon xanthoma. So please make that part of your physical examination. The other thing you should know, actually just published a paper on this, is that Achilles tendon xanthomas occur about 2% of the time in FH. So although we used to think it was much more prevalent, the fact is it's actually fairly rare to see an Achilles tendon xanthoma. Still nice to look for. So we also, like we have gain-of-function mutations, we have the loss-of-function mutations. And loss-of-function mutations were initially described in this very important paper that evaluated the ARIC trial for 15 years and looked at sequence variants in PCSK9, and specifically sequence variants that lowered LDL cholesterol. And here you see the African-American population, about 2% of them, about 2%, which is a pretty decent number, had PCSK9 variants that lowered LDL cholesterol about 40 milligrams per deciliter, conveying an 88% reduction in cardiovascular risk. So that's huge. The Caucasians had mutations that had a little less of an impact, about an 18% reduction in LDL cholesterol, translating to a lower, 47% reduction in coronary heart disease risk. But still, comparable. And then here's a litany of mutations that are loss of function that can cause this drop in LDL cholesterol and a concomitant drop in ASCVD events. This is another pedigree, and this is cool pedigree because it shows what's called the compound heterozygote. So you have different types of homozygotes. You have a simple homozygote who has a single and same mutation that's inherited from mother and father. So both alleles for whatever gene we're looking at have the single same mutation. A compound heterozygote has in that gene a different mutation from mother and father. And this is what this is, a compound heterozygote. That is also, by the way, a homozygote. It's a very confusing lexicon, but that is a homozygote. Even more confusing is something called the double heterozygote. And a double heterozygote is an individual with two genes that affect a certain function having mutations, one from mother, one from father. So this is a compound heterozygote, and you can see the circle that says 2 next to it, that the LDL is 14. This person makes no PCSK9, is in her 50s, and has absolutely no vascular disease, but also no other disorders, which is very enlightening. So the low LDL, lifelong low LDL cholesterol, has not caused any neurologic abnormalities, any storagenic abnormalities. This is a perfectly healthy individual. So in summary, PCSK9 regulates the hepatic surface expression of the LDL receptor, and we see what that can do, up or down. And we see that there are various mutations that can impact LDL cholesterol and concomitantly ASCVD. So when the PCSK9 was discovered, it was recognized as a tremendous opportunity for a lipid-lowering target. And the companies got very involved, and in 2007, Amgen actually solved the crystal structure of PCSK9, and now we have two drugs that have been approved as PCSK9 inhibitors for reduction of LDL cholesterol. They are evolocumab and alirocumab. They're both human monoclonal antibodies directed against PCSK9. We already understand the physiology, so I won't go through that again. But they're both approved, and this is very important. They were both approved last year, July and August, for LDL cholesterol reduction in individuals with clinical ASCVD or heterozygous FH who require greater reduction of LDL cholesterol on maximally tolerated statin therapy. And the important caveat there, or the little subtlety there, is maximally tolerated statin therapy could be zero. So if you have a patient who cannot tolerate a statin and has ASCVD or heterozygous FH, and remember, everybody in this room has patients with heterozygous FH in his or her practice. If you have one of these patients and you require a greater LDL reduction, and that can be whatever you decide you want it to be, then you can prescribe a PCSK9 inhibitor. So does that mean that we should be prescribing PCSK9 inhibitors to all of our statin intolerant patients? And the answer is no. And you can think about it like a Venn diagram where you have ASCVD, heterozygous FH, and statin intolerance on the bottom, and there's going to be intersection. It's in that intersection of statin intolerance with ASCVD or with heterozygous FH that we can prescribe this drug. So we don't go after just our statin intolerant patients, but we don't let statin intolerance dissuade us from prescribing a PCSK9 inhibitor if the patient has ASCVD or heterozygous FH and LDL needs to be reduced further. And this is showing physiologically what happens with the PCSK9 inhibitor. You'll see that it's blocked because it's bound to the antibody. It's blocked from binding to the LDL receptor, and consequently it cuts off that whole destruction of the LDL receptor. So now you have more LDL receptors, you have greater ability to bring LDL particles internally for degradation, and you have a lower LDL cholesterol. As monotherapy, we can get about a 50% reduction in LDL cholesterol with the PCSK9 inhibitors, and as combination therapy, up to 70%. And I just did one slide like this, Greg. Greg is going to take us through the whole, all the trials. But I just wanted to show you that we look at this line to see an association between cardiovascular events and degree of LDL cholesterol reduction. And CTT is a meta-analysis that included 26 RCTs on statins. And there's CTT sitting in the middle, and it shows that with a given reduction in LDL cholesterol, you get a given reduction in cardiovascular events. Lower down, you have IMPROVE-IT, which looked at Zetia, and there was a less of an LDL cholesterol reduction, but still a statistically significant reduction in cardiovascular events. And all the way on top, you have OSLER and you have ODYSSEY long-term, which are PCSK9 trials that demonstrated that with this massive LDL cholesterol reduction, you have an even more massive reduction in cardiovascular events. Now, these were not true outcomes trials, but still they demonstrated outcomes, and they fit right on the line. And the only thing I want you to see on this one, it's a PKPD slide, is that within 4 hours of injecting a PCSK9 inhibitor, all of the PCSK9 in our blood is bound by the monoclonal antibody. So it takes 4 hours, and we bind everything. There are two mechanisms of clearance. The first is the nonlinear pathway. This is just binding of the antibody to the PCSK9. And the second is a linear pathway. That's through the RES. And both pathways come into play. And then the dose-ranging studies were done. So these drug doses were not just pulled out of a hat. They do dose-ranging studies. And this is placebo, and you see what happens every 2 weeks to give 140 milligrams. This happens to be for evolocumab, 140 milligrams every 2 weeks versus 70 milligrams. And then you have on the right 420 monthly versus 280 monthly. And the key point here is the goal in choosing a proper dose of a drug is to get a dose that gives you as little inter-individual and intra-individual variability as possible. So you would like to create an intensive and predictable drug, and that's in fact what these drugs are. They have an intensive response to LDL cholesterol, and they have a very predictable response with very little of a sawtooth, of a rise and fall of LDL levels. This is my one political slide, which is that the PCSK9 inhibitors, though excellent drugs, and though FDA approved in July and August last year for those indications that I told you, and there is one other indication for homozygous FH, but that, again, very rare. But although approved for that, 90% of PCSK9 inhibitors have been denied by insurance companies to date. And they're saying it's because doctors are waiting for outcomes data, but that's not what's going on at all. We already understand that the LDL hypothesis is no longer a hypothesis, and that's another talk unto itself. But we have Mendelian randomization studies, and I kind of showed you a little hint of that. We have other studies that have demonstrated a clear causal relationship between LDL and events, cardiovascular events. So that's not what we're waiting for. We're prescribing. The insurance companies are denying. And so there's a big battle going on right now. And I would encourage everybody to stay in this battle. So when you prescribe the drug and you get denied, I would have your patients call the insurance company, because I actually went to the insurance commissioner to talk about this. You have your patients call the insurance company, and then you call after that. So in summary, PCSK9 regulates the hepatic surface expression of the LDL receptor, which in turn regulates LDL cholesterol amount and LDL particle amount. Mutations, both gain of function and loss of function, have really shown us the value of PCSK9, how it influences LDL cholesterol. And the PCSK9 inhibitors do actually represent a realization of a prior revelation, and that revelation was, hey, we think PCSK9 has a major modulatory effect on LDL cholesterol and could be a great target for intervention. Thank you very much.
Amazing that I got that up. I want to thank Jonathan for the nice intro, and Seth, what can I say? I learned a lot. Very, very good, and you set the table perfectly for me. So just quickly, Seth did the hard part. He gave you the science, which can be very complicated, and I have the easy part. Just to sort of summarize the clinical trials, and actually we're going to look at the Osler and Odyssey long-term studies, which he showed you on the graph. But before we do, this was a tag team effort, and I wanted to have a little bit of fun. So when I thought about tag team, it brought me back to my childhood, and I'm going to admit to you that, yes, I was and still am a professional wrestling fan. And when I was a little boy, these were the tag team champs, Mr. Fuji and Professor Toru Tanaka. I don't know if that rings any bells with anybody, but, oh, these were bad, bad guys. They were the champs for a long, long time. And, boy, you really hated them. You know, they made it so. And this was when wrestling was real, by the way, not like today. I'll never forget one time, because they usually didn't show you any of the major matches on TV at that time, but these two, Tony Garea and Dean Ho, were the good guys, and they actually finally beat the two, Professor Toru Tanaka and Mr. Fuji, and they actually showed the match on TV. It was a great match, and I'll never forget how happy I was that the bad guys lost. So here's a couple of other tag teams that are famous throughout the years. The Hart Foundation, Bret the Hitman Hart, and Jim the Anvil Neidhart on the left, and the Road Warriors. But the best tag team, at least as far as comic relief is concerned, and this will be the last slide here, is these guys called the Bushwhackers. And yeah, that's about how they acted. I think they're from New Zealand, and whether they were sober when they wrestled or not, I don't know, but they sure acted real goofy. So I hope our tag team's a little bit better than them anyway. So moving on, Seth gave you the indications. I'm going to fly through this in the interest of time. The only thing to say is that this is the limitation at this time, is that the effect of these medications on morbidity and mortality has not been definitively stated, because we just don't have the data yet. But what we do have, I am going to show you. So this is an overview of what's called the ODYSSEY clinical program. This is for alirocumab. And again, you don't have to look at all of these different things, but you can see that each one of these blocks is a different trial in a different subset of patients. This is in heterozygous FH patients. These are in high-risk cardiovascular disease risk patients. And what we're going to look at is this trial right here called the long-term trial. And this trial, which we'll talk about briefly, the outcomes trial, is really the granddaddy that everybody's waiting for, but it is still ongoing and will be ongoing for a while. So this study, the ODYSSEY long-term, was published in New England Journal last April, a year ago, April 2015. And this is the study design. So these were patients who were either heterozygous FH or had documented cardiovascular disease or were at high cardiovascular risk, and whose LDL cholesterol was at least 70, and that were already on maximally tolerated statin therapy. Again, the key line there, maximally tolerated statin therapy, doesn't mean that all patients were on high dose, high potency therapy, but they were also allowed to be on other lipid lowering therapy as well. And this group of patients was randomized to receive alirocumab, in this case a Q2 week injection, or placebo. You can see they were randomized in a 2-to-1 fashion, roughly about 2,500 patients. They were followed double-blind fashion out 78 weeks, a year and a half, and then at that time the double-blinding was released and everybody was followed up for another 8 weeks. The primary efficacy point was at week 24. This is an overview of the baseline, baseline characteristics of the trial. And again, you can look at this for yourself and basically see there's patients with cardiovascular disease, et cetera, et cetera. What's not on here, I will tell you that basically everybody was on statin therapy except for two patients. And roughly, I think it was around 50%, maybe a little bit less, were on high-dose statin therapy. And roughly 30% were receiving other lipid-lowering therapy in addition. This is, again, similar to what Seth had showed you previously. These are the results of the LDL cholesterol levels. You can see between placebo and the alirocumab, a 62% reduction in LDL cholesterol levels at the primary endpoint at 24 weeks. There appears to be a little bit of a drop-off at the final 78 weeks. The reason for that is there were some dropouts in the alirocumab group, but if you look at the study participants who took the medicine the entire time, the LDL lowering effect was consistent throughout. These are the effects of the drug on other important parameters. So as lipidologists and very much involved in the field of prevention, Seth, I know, feels the same way. We're increasingly looking at non-HDL as a better marker of cardiovascular risk as opposed to just LDL cholesterol. And you can see, again, a 52% reduction there. And even better, perhaps, ApoB, which is a direct measurement of LDL particle number, not just LDL particle number, atherogenic particle number overall. Again, a 54% reduction, and something that we'll talk about briefly at the end. There's even an effect on another particle called LP little a, or lipoprotein little a, which is an LDL particle that has a protein attached to it. That's what the little a is. And this is something that's genetically determined, not lifestyle determined. And the big thing why this is exciting is that we really have no good therapy for Lp(a) at this time. So we'll come back to that at the end. Here are some other effects. You can see a not too bad effect, about 17% on triglycerides, and a mild increase in HDL cholesterol and ApoA1, which is the major protein on HDL particles. So the higher your A1 is, the more HDL particles you have. And here they broke it down by the patients in the study that were heterozygous FH versus the non-FH population. And essentially what you see here is the effect was essentially the same in both. Now, as far as the cardiovascular events, this was a post hoc analysis. So we have to be careful in how we interpret this. But if you look, you can see that there's not really much difference outside of the individual non-fatal MI, where there was a statistically significant reduction. However, they also did what's called a composite endpoint, which is MACE, major adverse cardiovascular events, which includes the top four here. And when you do that, you'll see that there were 27 events in the alirocumab patients versus 26 in the placebo group, which equated to a 48% reduction in clinical events, which was statistically significant. Again, cautioning, this is a small number of events, a post hoc analysis, so nothing that you want to bet the house on. Now, as far as adverse events are concerned, this is obviously a topic that has become increasingly important. This is a general overview of things. And again, if you look between the two groups, you'll see basically no difference in terms of any adverse events, serious adverse events, deaths. But we're going to go a little more in detail here. And this is a very, very busy slide. And we, again, don't want you to look at everything here, but just a few things we're going to focus on. First off is this middle column is the group of the alirocumab patients whose LDL cholesterol was less than 25. You can see it was roughly 600 of those patients. So one of the thoughts or questions that's been asked is, are statin side effects dose-related, or is it, in fact, related to the level of LDL cholesterol that's achieved, meaning the lower it goes, the more side effects you have, the more muscle aches, the more neurocognitive events. And if you look through all these different columns, and including these 600 patients with very, very low LDLs, you will see no difference. So it doesn't appear that there is any correlation between the side effects and the level of LDL cholesterol achieved. Now, the big ones that we're going to look at, first, the musculoskeletal and connective tissue disorders. Now, again, this is broad, but needless to say, in clinical practice, the biggest bugaboo for most patients, most doctors taking care of patients prescribing statins is muscle events, muscle aches, muscle pains. And there was actually an increased number of myalgia in the alirocumab versus placebo. But again, no connection between the level of LDL cholesterol achieved and those events. The other one of note is the nervous system disorders. And to get more specific on that, again, you'll see no real difference between the groups. There was an increased number of neurocognitive disorders, but it's a very small number here. And again, you can see there's really no difference no matter how low your LDL cholesterol goes. So this is something that is going to be a major issue going forward. And I think any trial now of statin, new drug, anything where LDL cholesterol is being lowered, there is going to be a very significant look at neurocognitive side effects. So the long-term, the conclusions from this study, basically Over a 78-week period, alirocumab was very effective in lowering LDL cholesterol by about 62% and, in general, very well tolerated without any major side effects. This is an overview of the outcome study. So this, again, is the major study that we'll be able to hang our hat on, so to speak. And basically, the patients will be getting high-dose, high-potency statins, again, randomized double-blind to alirocumab and placebo, and followed out for a period over 5 years for cardiovascular events. So we'll look forward to hearing that. Now, as far as the OSLA program is concerned, this is with evolocumab, and basically you'll see a grouping of trials up here, some phase two, some phase three, again in these various groups, some by itself, some in statin intolerant patients, et cetera, and the OSLA study comprised roughly 4,500 patients that were derived from these various phase two and phase three studies. They were then randomized in a 2-to-1 fashion to receive evolocumab or standard of care. They were followed up for about a year, and you can see roughly 7% discontinued. Now, what's important to know here is that this was an open label study. So the researchers, the patients, everybody involved in the care of the patient knew they were receiving the drug. This also was published in New England Journal a year ago in the same issue as the long-term study, which I showed you. The dosing of the evolocumab was either every 2 weeks or every month. And as Seth showed you, the LDL reductions are roughly the same either way. Here are the various endpoints, primarily adverse events, LDL cholesterol lowering, and other lipid parameters. And they did do cardiovascular outcomes, but this was pre-specified. It was exploratory, but the adjudicators were blinded to treatment. So at least this portion of the trial is blinded. Here are the baseline characteristics. Again, you'll see the pretty typical spread here. Lots of risk factors, lots of known vascular disease. This is the breakdown of statin use in these patients. You'll see that 70% were on statins, 30% were not, obviously. And of the 70% on statins, roughly half were on moderate dose and about 40% on high dose. Here are the results from evolocumab, and you can see very similar to the prior study, about a 61% reduction in LDL cholesterol levels at the 12-week time frame, which was the primary endpoint. And again, a consistent reduction throughout the length of the study. When it came to achieving LDL cholesterol goals, 90% receiving evolocumab achieved the less than 100 level, and about 74% less than 70. Those numbers are astounding to any of you in practice that try to aggressively treat your patients. To get that number of patients down to a very low level is very, very difficult. And while I did not mention for the previous study, the long-term study, similar numbers of patients achieved the less than 70 in the Odyssey long-term. Here are the effects on other lipid parameters, and as we saw again in the Odyssey long-term, a very significant drop in non-HDL, ApoB, and again in LP little a, and similar findings with triglycerides and HDL cholesterol and ApoA1. Not quite as impressive, but still a move in the right direction. And then here we have the Kaplan-Meier curves for the cardiovascular events, which was a composite endpoint of death, MI, unstable angina resulting in hospitalization, coronary revascularization, stroke, TIA, or congestive heart failure resulting in hospitalization. And you see a wide separation here with a 53% reduction in events and a separation after roughly sometime between 2 and 3 months. As far as safety is concerned, again, you will see that compared to the standard of care alone, there was not really any significant difference between the drug and standard treatment. for these various different aspects. There was more neurocognitive events, but again, very low numbers. And once again, when we look at these adverse events by LDL cholesterol achieved, there is no correlation between the level of LDL cholesterol and the number of events. So the summary, LDL cholesterol reduced by 61% at 12 weeks, cardiovascular outcomes by 53%, and again, overall appeared to be a safe and well-tolerated drug with no gradient in the side effects with achieved LDL cholesterol level. So while, again, these are not the kind of trials that you would want to, you know, base everything on and hang your hat on, this is what we have so far. And I think they bode good things for the longer outcome studies to come. So to finish up very quickly, what are the potential future uses of PCSK9? Because as Seth said, and I went through it very quickly, right now these drugs are only approved in combination with maximally tolerated statin therapy. Again, the caveat being maximally tolerated. So down the road, perhaps we will see these approved as monotherapy, but time will tell. I think this is perhaps the most intriguing one, the statin intolerant patients. And as you saw, there were a number of trials with each of the drugs in statin intolerant patients. And so a lot of hope that again, a very vague group that encompasses, I'm sure, lots of real and imagined problems, but a very difficult group to treat. And so this may be something that will be very effective for these patients. And lastly, as I mentioned, patients who have elevated levels of Lp(a). So reminding you, this is, again, a particle that's been clearly linked with an increased risk of cardiovascular disease, but is really genetically determined. It is not really affected by your diet, your exercise, your weight. And the only medicine, per se, that we've had that has a significant effect on Lp(a) is niacin. And while niacin can lower Lp(a) levels to approximately 30%, the big problem, as many of you know, is getting your patients to a high enough dose that they tolerate to achieve that effect. So potentially, this is a, and before I go there, so currently, and part of the problem is there are no outcome studies with patients with isolated Lp(a) levels. So the only data that we have really suggests that the way to treat these patients is to lower their LDL cholesterol levels to very low levels. Below 70, below 65, there is no consensus, but the general consensus is lower in these patients is better. So hopefully, if the studies are done, this may be an alternative for these patients, or at least something that can be added to the mix that's well-tolerated, certainly potentially better tolerated than higher-dose niacin therapy without some of the other effects that niacin has. So with that, I will stop, and I think Seth can come back up, and we can take some questions if there are any.
That is actually very valuable. I did not know that, and I did go up to Tallahassee and spoke with the insurance commissioner, and he was unaware of the problem,
that's why.
And that's why. That's so interesting. Thank you.
Okay, second thing is that statins also
Well, I'll start. Greg can continue. But HDL has disappointed us, as everybody knows, in all the major clinical outcome trials. And HDL has failed Mendelian randomization studies as well. So HDL is not clearly causally related to cardiovascular disease. So we don't know what it means to increase HDL or to decrease HDL. We do know it's associated with coronary disease, and there are a couple of isolated genetic circumstances where HDL is, in a greater sense, related to cardiovascular disease, even with high HDL causing, believe it or not, coronary disease, and low causing coronary disease as well. So the answer really is we don't know. It looks like it's going to turn out that the issue is going to be one of functionality. How well does the HDL function? That's going to determine efficacy of manipulating HDL.
Just, I would just tweak a little bit. No question, statins do not have a potent HDL effect, HDL cholesterol effect. Generally, it's to the increase, although it depends on the statin and the dose. Some do it better than others. That's one. And just to, again, tweak a little bit what Seth said, we're really talking about HDL cholesterol as not being the marker. HDL particle number, other things may be better markers of the good things that HDL does, which ties in with this idea of functionality, which is still a scientist's dream right now. We don't have a good clinical test for it. Yes, if I can figure out how to get back. Sorry, it's slow.
It was the opposite, though, in reality.
It was.
So in other words, there was about a 50% reduction in events on drug. So I don't know.
Yeah, down at the bottom, positively adjudicated cardiovascular events, including all cardiovascular events listed. So.
Oh, but look at the total number.
Right. You have to remember that there's twice as many patients in the alirocumab group as there is in the placebo. Oops, sorry.
Yeah.
And again, whether this is just, you know, the study authors, you know, cherry picking, their endpoint was this. What they picked was this MACE, which were the top four. Okay, 1, 2, 3, and 4. So that would include all of these events here. Okay, and that's where they got the 48% reduction that was statistically significant.
But just as another connector here, if you look at Osler's long-term study and Odyssey's long-term study, so, you know, you have two
long...
Well, it was done a little more robustly for outcomes, but it was about a 52% reduction in events versus a 47% reduction. They were very close. I mean, they were very similar. So, So you would say that they. It looks like there's something there. You, as Greg said, you wouldn't bet your hat on it, but you might bet something else.
And the one other thing, so I make it sound like, you know, the authors were just trying to get a positive endpoint. The reason they picked MACE is that is the endpoint for the Odyssey the Odyssey outcome study, that big one that's ongoing. So it's directly comparable to that study.
Any other questions? Come on. There is no criteria for 3 weeks. Every 4 weeks is only indicated for evolocumab for homozygous FH. So that's the only indication. And right now, that's given as 3 injections of 140 within a 30-minute span because they don't have a 420 injection at this point. That's they will have that soon.
I think that's key because it's too circumstantial to just withdraw it and the pain goes away. You need to reintroduce it to really prove that it's the drug.
If they say it goes away in 3 days, you know they're wrong.
Right.
And the other part of that is if you really want to, you know, I mean, be very specific about this, you can create an image, you know, an image of an individual and have them mark down before you start them on statin therapy where their pain is, because everybody's got pain. So they'll mark down, my shoulder hurts, my knee hurts, blah, blah, blah. And then they come back 6 weeks later complaining of statin-induced pain, and you ask them to mark down on that piece of paper where their pain is, and it's in the exact same spot. You go, well, look, you know, you did this 6 weeks ago. I don't think it's a statin. So some people are doing that as well.
Yeah, one thing for the residents, the CBKs are almost never up to statin-induced pain.
Right.
And just as a continuation of that thought for the residents, there's something called macro CPK, and you can actually look for that with electrophoresis, and it's just a big CPK, and it is totally benign. And so these people sit with 400 or 500 CPK, and doctors are often afraid of using statin therapy on them, and you shouldn't be. So.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Beautiful, beautiful job.
Thank you. You too. Thanks for very well.
Is this your?
No.
No. Okay.
I don't know who that is. Huh.